American Public Square at Jewel, I'm Allison Kelzer, and you're listening to At the Square. Welcome to another episode of Both Sides. Thanks for joining us for another civil conversation featuring APS founder Alan Katz on the left and co-chair to APS's advisory board Mike McShane on the right. This week, we talked to the founders of Sophic Solutions, Dr. Rodney Smith and Stephen E. K. Smith. Before we listen to the conversation, let's learn about Sophic Solutions and its founders. Sophic Solutions is a change management and consulting firm based in Kansas City, Missouri. Managing partners Rodney and Stephen E. Smith come together with over 40 years of combined experience to offer management solutions to large and small business entities and not-for-profit agencies, specifically providing educational consultation to schools and school districts, offering change management solutions to a variety of organization types, and conducting diversity, equity, and inclusion training for various companies and associations. Dr. Rodney D. Smith is co-founder and managing partner at Sophic Solutions. Rodney is Sophic's lead authority on issues related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. His expertise specifically pertains to African American student achievement, urban education, and culturally responsive pedagogy. Over the course of a 25-year career, Dr. Smith's scholarly interests have taken aim at the implications of race and racism in American society. Dr. Smith recently wrote and published, Are We Really Crabs in a Barrel? The Truth and Other Insights About the African American Community, as well as a chapter in an anthology titled, The Trayvon Martin in Us, an American Tragedy. His wife and managing partner of Sophic Solutions is Stephen E. K. Smith. Stephen E. is Sophic's lead authority on operationalizing equity, executive project management, organizational structure and design, and operations improvement. She has led a number of efforts to align non-for-profit policy with community investments, with a special emphasis on large-scale transformation. With over 20 years of experience, Stephen E. has leveraged her social work background to explicitly focus on the effects of poverty and oppression. Now let's listen to our conversation with Rodney and Stephen E., recorded on June 3rd, 2020.
Okay, first of all, I'd like to welcome you here today. We really appreciate your being part of Both Sides, our podcast. And so I'd sort of like to give you a chance to the beginning here. If you can sort of just tell us what you do professionally in terms of how you approach these issues and how it relates to what's going on in Kansas City today and to the country writ large.
Well, thank you, Alan and Mike, for inviting us on. I'm Stephen E. Smith. And I'm excited to serve as the managing partner and thought partner in this work of Sophic Solutions. Sophic Solutions is a change management solutions firm. And so we really focus on helping people and organizations navigate change through an equity lens. And so it is a opportunity for me to really be able and what's powerful, what I believe is powerful about the connection and the work that we're doing is that we're able to take this multidisciplinary approach to problem solving. My background as a social worker is leveraged in every way, in every day in the work, and really meeting people where they are at, seeking to understand so that I can help support and help people navigate. I had some time in some work as a therapist. And so I even get a chance to delve into the therapeutic background, but also have served in operations. So I worked for a nonprofit where we were completely community oriented and community facing and was able to help revitalize and renovate a building here in the Kansas City, Missouri area. So just bringing all of that skill set, and then Rodney, of course, has his own.
Yeah, so I'm Rodney Smith. I'm the other half of Sophic Solutions. In addition to Sophic Solutions, I'm also, I like to believe that I'm a scholar. I moonlight also at UMKC, particularly in the School of Education in its graduate program where I specialize in courses dealing with race, racism, diversity, equity, inclusion. So I've taught courses for the School of Education at UMKC for the past 8 years. And prior to that, I was also on the administrative side of the house at UMKC, where I was the director of mentoring and support. but most of my experience has been in higher education administration. But strangely and oddly enough, my undergrad degree is in architecture. So I worked at an architecture firm in Atlanta for a couple of years prior to going back to grad school for education. So I have a master's degree and a doctoral degree, both in ed leadership and administration. So, and been a part of a couple of writing projects and things of that nature. So consider myself an author as well.
I was just going to say, I'd love to pick up on, you used a few terms there that I think would maybe be helpful for our listeners to unpack. And I was perusing your great website, the services you offer and everything. And you mentioned the terms diversity, equity, inclusion. And then there was another word on your website that I thought that I appreciated, would like to hear you talk about, belonging.
Yeah.
So as you look at these different terms, I think sometimes these terms are used interchangeably, or people think that they're the same, but how do you kind of articulate and unpack this idea of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging?
Yeah. So diversity is, you know, I don't mean this in a flippant way. Diversity just is, right? Diversity, humanity is extremely diverse. I mean, I often jokingly say when we go outside and we see a beautiful bed of flowers with a variation of flowers, we don't say, oh, look at that beautiful, diverse bed of flowers.
Right.
We just say,
is this a bouquet?
It's a beautiful bouquet of flowers. So too is humanity.
That's right.
And but I think what we mean when we say we need to be better at diversity and we need to have a more diverse staff, I think what we really mean is that we need to do better with regard to people in decision-making, empowerment, and power positions. We that's need right. to do a better job of diversifying those roles. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's what diversity really means in that regard.
Yeah.
So because diversity, I mean, in its truest sense of the word, just, I mean, humanity is very diverse.
That's right. And inclusion is the act. It is the actual verb. It is what we are doing and what it looks like, how it shows up. And that is the practice that if we just stop at diversity and recognize what is, then we're not doing the work to incorporate diversities through the various channels or through the various levels within an organization or within the opportunity. And then when you move into equity, it is being very clear. It's one, recognizing that there has been, that there's a need to redistribute power and to change structures. Equity is steeped in system navigation. It's not just the program. It's not just, and there's nothing wrong with programs, but oftentimes when we think that a program can do the work of really what systems change is doing, then we become disappointed because that program is gonna fall short. Mm-hmm. Because we have to ask the question about how is it systemically, how is the process and the flow and what are the practices and the policies that continue to produce the outcomes. Mm-hmm. And then when we get to belonging, mm-hmm. and Mike, I really appreciate you calling out and bringing out the belongingness, because sometimes we just say diversity, equity, and inclusion. But belongingness is really about the feel. It's about the culture of what is happening. Mm-hmm. And if we don't call out belongingness, then we might be confused that saming is belonging, yeah. that us being the same mm-hmm. produces belonging.
Yeah.
But no, because then that leaves out inclusion, which then gives us no permission to engage diversity. Right. So belongingness is about what does it take? What does it feel like?
Yeah.
And what are the things that are happening that lets us know that yeah. this is where I belong and I'm valued?
So I think sometimes in our efforts to try to include people, we assume that saming is including because we expect people to be the same and act the same and do the same things. But it is in fact the polar opposite of belonging, because belonging allows people to be who they are and just belong in our various organizations. And equity, and most often, is in direct relation to inequity. We recognize that there's been inequity in our past in America, in an American context. We recognize that. I mean, I'll give you a perfect example. ADA compliance, you know, we recognize that we were inequitable in how we situated our buildings and provided access for people who needed access, who couldn't have it by going upstairs or by opening doors for themselves or by getting on different floors in our building. So what did we do? We incorporated ramps in every building now. We have automatic doors you can hit buttons to go into. You have elevators in buildings because we recognize that we were being inequitable in access. People could not get access.
Right.
And that exercise in equity helped us all because I sometimes use ramps to get in buildings, but I don't need to. I really don't need to. I sometimes push that button and the automatic doors open, though I really don't need to. And I certainly use elevators because sometimes I don't want to walk up multiple flights of stairs. Yeah. So equity typically helps more than the people who it was aimed to be helped.
And not only was it just a set of practices that happened, but that ADA, that is a law, right? So now we've leveraged policy to enact it. So whenever we talk about the need for racial equity or better inclusion or all those things that kind of bring us to the conversation, oftentimes it just stops at a moral dilemma. But we realize and see the need to really engage systems and structures to really demonstrate what the belief is, which the belief for the ADA example is that people should have access and be able to move freely in and throughout a building.
And
that's the belief that promotes the behaviors.
Yeah. Okay, let me pick up on some of the things that you all have been talking about here. You might sort of start talking about words from your website. One of the things I'd like you to address is this. We know that that people of goodwill talk past each other sometimes. Right. Some people use, and what happens is we all react to phrases or words, perhaps in a way that they were never meant. But people who are using those words don't understand what the emotional reaction is going to be on the other side. So do you have some thoughts about help for people who, white people, people of color, in terms of things they ought to think about? And again, you know, I'm my sense of things is that there's some obvious words that are offensive, but there's a whole bunch of other things that can get get the reaction that you don't want to get.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that it all starts with listening and being present, unless the goal is to agitate. You know, and this is not giving agitation a bad name, because, you know, we oftentimes talk about and give example to, and this is probably an old example because now washing machines are different, but you remember what that thing in the middle of a washing machine is called? That's the agitator. And oftentimes agitation does what? It can get things clean. It can draw things out. And when we draw those things out, it gives us an opportunity to really then go deeper to understand. Understanding is at the crux of any decision or problem solving measure. Any opportunity for us to solve a problem has to first come with us understanding it. Einstein talked about if he had an hour to figure out something, he would spend 55 minutes studying the problem and the remainder of the time fixing it. So understanding is the key. But I think, Alan, your point about words and how sometimes words, how we can get emotionally hijacked.
Yeah.
And that emotional, emotionality takes us in directions where now it just is about defensiveness and not about problem solving or not about understanding what the situation is. So it's always something, and we're human, right? So words trigger us, smells trigger us, behaviors trigger us. And so that's why it always starts with us.
Yeah. And while obviously we have an appreciation for agitation, short of that, you know, my wife often says we have to consider the racial or identity implications of our decisions, of what we say, of what we do. We have to consider those racial and or identity implications. Meaning you have to think about how is this going to affect
that person,
my surroundings. But we, in order to do that, you have to have a healthy understanding of history, of what has happened in our country. And so I often say we're negligent if we don't consider history as we interact with ourselves today, because we cannot divorce ourselves of our country's past. and what is a better life today.
Let me just follow up on that. So here's really kind of the crux of the dilemma that one of the dilemmas I think we have as a society, and that is, let's put agitation to the side, because okay, I understand what that is, and I understand what that role is, and something else we'll talk about a little later in terms of whether or not civility is basically you have to be privileged in order to be able to afford civility, which is a different conversation. But
yes, it is.
To me, the question is this: if people are good, people are going to be given the benefit of the doubt. In other words, we know something about each other, not a lot, but we know that everyone is trying to come together to sort of address a problem. Should we give each other a pass if a term is used that would normally be, you know, cause heartburn, but we know what the person's trying to say, and we're all trying to get to the same place? Or do we stop them there and explain to them that word or that phrase has a negative connotation so they won't use it next time? And how do you do it in a way that really makes things not just fall apart?
Yes.
Well, I can see you both disagree on that. Go ahead.
Well, being nice is not good enough. Being nice doesn't change policies. Being nice doesn't change housing systems. Discrimination. Mm-hmm. Being nice doesn't change history of discrimination.
But can't people misuse words unintentionally, but still be oriented towards action and solving problems?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
But I often say another analogy that I use, if I were to step on your toe unintentionally, does it take the pain away? Mm-hmm. Your toe still hurts. And so we still have to acknowledge the act. Right. As opposed to getting upset that you are acknowledging that you're hurt.
That's right.
You know what I mean? A lot of times we spend so much time being upset that the person is saying that my toe is hurt. Well, I didn't mean to step on your toe.
That's right.
Well, I know you didn't mean to step on my toe, but it still hurts.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Well,
have to take responsibility for our actions,
and
in other words.
It's similar to what is happening now. I read a meme, and it said that most of y'all are more concerned about the buildings being burned down versus what caused the buildings to be burned down.
Yeah.
And so I use that, even though I realize it could be
inflammatory. Yeah.
But we have to remain focused on what the causation, because if we don't address causation ever, then we don't get to actually transforming the outcome. And so I believe in process, meaning that say we're having an interaction, we both recognize that it is with good intention, but if you don't pause me to educate me and to correct me and to better guide me, then how can I be better?
Yeah, how can I do better? Yeah.
And the whole premise of the righteous premise of America is about doing better and being better. Here we are in a time that we actually are slowing down enough as a society to actually do something better.
And have a conversation.
So we have to take advantage of that betterment, which is the conversation. And it is about producing the understanding.
And I would be interested to know your thoughts on sort of social media's role in this, because it seems to me so much of the sort of conversation that you're talking about and having these productive conversations in many ways is about sort of setting your ego aside. That if you say something that you didn't necessarily mean to say and someone corrects you, having the humility to say, oh, I'm sorry, to learn from that, to move on. And that seems to me to be something that's easier to do when you're sitting across the table having a cup of coffee with someone. But when that takes place on display in front of thousands of people, so if it's on your Facebook page or on a Twitter page or something, then people get defensive, right? Because it's you're being called out sort of in public. So I wonder, like, does social media just make this worse? And should people maybe not try to adjudicate these things, right? Like try and say, send them a message and be like, yo, can we like get a cup of coffee, or can we have some kind of more productive space where we can talk through this, as opposed to being so kind of performative about it? Cause it just seems to bring out the worst in everybody. I don't know. Maybe I could be totally wrong about that, but
yeah. No, I think we live in a world, Mike, of and both. I think that definitely social media has its place. It's part of our society. And for many people, it has given them permission to have voice in a way that they haven't. So, you know, social media brings a lot of positives into our space. And just like with anything else, it also can bring the negatives as well. Yeah, I think it was Drake, the conflict, the rap battle between Drake and Meek Mills. And they talked about when trigger fingers turn into Twitter fingers. And so sometimes we end up getting an electronic courage. We end up typing things that we would never say in person. And I don't know, I'm not necessarily saying that that is better or worse, but it does create a platform, is what I'm saying. Now, the question is, how do we connect the dots to move it from just speech to another form of action that is about change, that is about mobilizing, which is about evaluating? And I think that's where the work comes in, where we can come in hand, whether it's virtually or physically, but we're coming together to better understand, to be able to move forward. That's like the theme word for me today is understand. But it is so important. When we understand things better, it gives us permission and opportunity to do things better.
While social media is used by a wide swath of all types of people, I think it has also allowed a particular audience to have voice where they didn't have much of a voice in years past. Even as far as, you know, things, ancillary things like in the entertainment industry, there are a lot of people who have been discovered. Where they wouldn't have been discovered in years past had they not had the exposure of social media. Likewise, social media has allowed people to have a voice where in years past they didn't have a voice. And so now we are able to hear and listen a little bit better and sort of check the temperature of our society based on what we hear, read, and see via social media.
And this may be a function of age, because I'm the oldest person on this call, but it seems to me that I think it's at best kind of a pick'em between the positive and the negative of social media. Yeah. I think that we have had hate groups have had much greater purchase throughout our society. When in many ways, I think a lot of us hoped with the election of an African-American president that we were like moving in a certain direction. And what happened was for any number of reasons, these groups sprang back in a public forum, which they would not have been able to do absent social media. The other prejudice that I have, and I'd like you all to comment on this too, is that when we began American Public Square, and before that program in Florida called the Village Square, the central part of the idea was, if you want to really deal with problems and different points of view, you almost really need to do it in person. Which really goes to Stephanie's point, which is, you may send a real snarky email, but would you say that to the person if they were sitting in front of you? And I would argue for most of us,
that's right.
We wouldn't do that. We would be much more circumspect about it. So having said all that, whatever I think, whatever any of us think, social media is here. It's not going anywhere. So that's the question really is there a way we can make a more positive use of it and somehow push back on the negative aspects that undermine our democracy?
I absolutely think so. And I think, Alan, it starts with or can be helped by something you did in just you speaking now. You acknowledged some things. You said, well, hey, this is my prejudice, right? So you are already moving forth and setting the table for understanding, because one, you've done some work to acknowledge, right? Yeah. Which then gives us permission to be able to see that. And I don't then have to get hung up in trying to make a judgment about what your prejudice is about or not based upon my response to what you have to say.
Yeah.
And that type of transparency, whether we do it electronically or in person, always is the pathway. So, you know, when I think about how can we better engage or utilize the platform of social media, it would be similar to the advice I would say with how we can better communicate in person. It starts with transparency. It starts with a vulnerability that continues to produce cultural humility, meaning I don't know everything. I'm not going to act like I got it all figured out.
Yeah.
And then also doesn't play the dynamic of superiority versus inferiority. Because when we are in those battles with one another, especially when race is involved. So to Rodney's point, we understand that historically the racial arrangement has been based upon superiority and inferiority. So things that people say that trigger a feeling of inferiority or superiority from one another, then that becomes the battle. Not the content necessarily or the you know, the end game, but the battle is this tension between superiority and inferiority. So I think that just like in any other relationship opportunity, we get stuck in some of the quicksands of defensiveness, of fighting for clarity and space. Mm-hmm. And as much as we can move into a conversation, being transparent and having humility, I think the better it will be no matter what the platform.
Yeah. I don't have much to add other than I agree with you, Alan, that I think in this regard, we have to take the good with the bad. Mm-hmm. We just have to accept that that's a part of it. I mean, you know, it's like TV. You know, we used to say that, you know, some people call it the stupid box, but we get a lot of information through the TV. I watch the news every day. I mean, we would not be able to now even protect ourselves with COVID-19 and know what to do and wear a mask and wash our hands and without newscasters telling us what to do. And so we got to take the good and bad, but then there's also trash TV on as well. You know what I mean? So you have to you have to tune some of it out, and you have to, my wife would say, you have to eat the meat and spit out the bones.
That's a great way of putting it. You know, I think one of the things that I have been noticing in this past week, you know, amidst all of the horrible things that have been happening, has been a real outpouring from lots of people of goodwill who say, I want to help, but I don't really know how. And I think that I would love to hear your thoughts on, you know, there's young people. Yesterday, there was the whole movement across social media where people put the black box on their thing. And lots of people had the blackout. I'd been, my Instagram page went black for those things. And so I would love, obviously, like, that's a nice thing to do, but it doesn't really do anything. And I get that. So those sort of next steps, it seems like there's this, a lot of people out there who want to help, who want to do good things. So what can, and so I'm obviously gearing this more towards perhaps younger people, but all people of goodwill, what are some steps that they can take to help sort of mend some of these divisions?
I think that was a great example, Mike. I mean, that was an exercise in solidarity. That is an exercise in, I am with you. Mm-hmm. I hear you. Not only did I hear you, I'm going to respond to what I've heard you say, and I'm going to stand with you. Now, what is so interesting about the times that we're having right now with all of the protests and unfortunately with George Floyd losing his life, with Ahmaud Arbery losing his life,
Breonna Taylor
losing her life. I have gotten more phone calls from all walks of people, not just African-American people, but some of my white colleagues from UMKC and from friends that I've had across the country that are just checking in on me and say, hey, man, I just want to send an email to make sure you're okay. That has not happened before. This thing feels different this time for me personally. And it's just that gesture of, I'm with you, I see you, I hear you. In fact, typically I start off most conversations I have with students and when I'm in person, I start off with this South African greeting of Sawubona, which means I see you. And I feel seen by my friends and colleagues, acknowledging that they understand that I could be having experiences some trauma right now, mm-hmm. be it vicarious, but I'm still experiencing some trauma. I still have to navigate and negotiate being a black man in America, though, you know, I'm an educated black man. I typically wear suits when I drive in my car, but still, I mean, I don't fit this image of what America would say is a thug or all those kinds of things.
Even though, by the way, we believe that is completely erroneous.
Oh, it's erroneous. It is a crazy logic if you think about it. based on somebody's appearance, I would treat them a certain way. I mean, but that's beside the point. You know what I mean? I don't want to digress from the conversation. But I mean, I think what the point that I'm making is the point that you made earlier about showing solidarity.
Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, started online, right? Yeah. So once again, we get back into what are the things that stimulate us, that motivate us? And that's why I say, you know, you take both parts of it. And, you know, you talk about my goodwill and how far does goodwill take us, is what I got from your question. That wasn't your question, but that's what I heard. And it makes me think about something that I think is has to be part of the conversation. This mindset of a mercy mindset versus a justice mindset. Mm. And so is goodwill enough? Is being concerned or in some cases, like we talk about the mercy mindset really being centered in pitying people of color and it's all good intentions, right? I feel bad that something is happening. Look what's happening to many Black people is what many white people who see themselves as allies say. And so it focuses on actions that help maybe address things immediately. But justice, a just mindset really helps us focus on being concerned and committed to evaluating and changing the systems that produced it. So if we never move past mercy and focus and get squared on justice, then we're just being nice. And being nice doesn't necessarily change systems. What changes systems is evaluation, is speaking up, is calling out, is, you know, rewriting policies, electing new leaders. All those things mm-hmm. are really about what produces a just system versus just having pantries, setting up pantries so mm-hmm. that people can get something to eat if they're hungry. When really what a just mindset does is eradicate hunger.
Okay, well, yeah, let me just ask a question here, because I think it goes to sort of part of what we're talking about. Hopefully it does. And that is that the concept of equity and justice, they're different, but they're certainly related. It's sort of hard to sort of have justice without equity. And as we know, without justice, we're not getting equity. How much of this is a zero-sum game? Mm. How much of this, in other words, I've had conversations with friends who said that what has happened to the poorer communities in our cities is a direct result of the gains that have gone in the wealthier communities of our cities, which presents it as a zero-sum game. And so the question really is when people talk about lifting up portions of our community in terms of opportunity and access, et cetera, I fear that some people in the more well-off communities see this as taking something away from them, which isn't necessarily, by the way, the best way to get the lift up that we're looking for. What do you think about that?
No, you. I mean,
that's good, Alan.
Great question.
Taking us where we like to be.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the example that I gave about ADA compliance is a great example of, simply because we gave, you know, people who need ramps, that didn't take anything away from us. In fact, it gave us more access to the buildings. And we have to help people to understand that we're not taking anything from you. But but I think a good thing is recognizing and realizing, like if we look at Kansas City as an example, if we look at the formerly redlined communities, we spend a lot of time thinking about and talking about the formerly redlined communities, but we spend no time thinking about and talking about the formerly greenlined communities or the currently greenlined communities. They're in direct correlation with each other. If there's night, there has to be day. We can't distinguish night from day if there is not night and day. I mean, you know what I mean? If the sun, when the sun goes down, that's when we know it's night.
That's right.
You know what I mean? So there has to be an opposite. So we have to acknowledge that and address that, because, you know, Johnson County, if I'm you know, allowed to say, didn't just become Johnson County because they wanted to become Johnson County. You know what I mean? It was a direct relation. It was an outgrowth of some things that were happening mm-hmm. in and around the Truce Corridor that we often refer to, right? Mm-hmm. And people were moving out. This thing called flight, if we want to say it,
white flight.
Right.
You know, so we have to really, that's what I said, that most of this work, all of this work, has to be centered in history. We're negligent if we think we're going to make life better for ourselves without considering how we've gotten here. We have to know how we've gotten here.
Okay, yeah. But let me get back to my, I'm sorry, I'd like to get back to my point because I really think that.
I got some for you, Alan, but go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I mean, so I want to know whether you believe that it's a zero-sum game.
This is what I believe. Do you want to finish your thought? So this is what I believe is that if we are truly pursuing equity, we all have to figure out what am I willing, what does this mean? What does this shift mean for who I am? That's what I mean and what we mean by we have to understand and be able to realize, recognize what the implications are.
Right.
And so when we talk about, so one of the books we're reading right now talks about, and this is part of capitalism, right? This is part of the water that we swim in, that there is a whole group that exists just to have less because their existence creates a platform for others to have more, a specific group of others to have more. So if we're serious about really, and that's why the struggle has been 400 years.
Yeah.
Right? When we talk about these 400 plus years of, and that is why racism is a major tool to perpetuate capitalism. Because everybody knows that race is specious, it's false. It's not true, right? There is no biological difference, but the implications are real.
Very real.
Right? But race in and of itself, there's no biological difference.
Yeah.
But race needed to happen so that capitalism could thrive because there needed to be a group that existed to have less so that those that were less could create more for the others. So when we really think about the examination that it takes to really dismantle a system that is steeped in capitalism, which leverages racism to do the work, then we're talking about that dismantling.
Yeah.
But I would also encourage us to think about third choice thinking. If we only think that it's capitalism or, and we have this binary thinking, then how do we ever move past that to be the type of society that we're capable of being in a 21st century? Mm-hmm. But it is a clear, honest analysis that happens. Because Alan, you're right. That's why people are more interested in mercy. Oh, I feel really bad. Mm-hmm. Look at, you know what? Let me do my part. Let me give $25 or $25,000, mm-hmm. right? I can do that. But what I'm not willing to do is change the system that keeps producing this outcome.
Right, that I need to give somebody 25.
That's right.
So the quick answer for me is no, it is not a zero-sum game, but it becomes a zero-sum game when we believe it is a zero-sum game. In other words, we have to stay focused on the goal. Like you've seen the cartoon that was floating around the internet years ago where these little boys are trying to watch a baseball game looking over a fence. And this is a conversation between equity and equality. And you gave, they were all different heights. There's three different boys and they were all different heights. They were trying to watch the baseball game over this wooden fence. They gave all three of them the same size box to stand on to try to look over the fence. Well, the little short guy couldn't see over the fence. So what they had to do is give him two boxes to stand on and give the medium-sized guy one box, and the tall guy didn't need a box at all because the goal was for them to see the game, not how many boxes they had. You know what I mean? So we get caught up in, well, you got more boxes than I have. Well, I need more boxes.
Okay. And the third choice thinking in that same scenario is to remove the fence, right? So that nobody needs a box. We remove the fence.
I love it, babe.
That is the third choice thinking that we're talking about and the third choice thinking that it takes to really actualize change.
And some would argue then removing the fence equals justice.
Well, look, we are running out of time here. I would love to continue the conversation because as the resident capitalist on the podcast, I would love to talk because my only two cents on this is that I totally agree with you of the many of the historical implications here. But I think capitalism properly understood is the classic example of a non-zero-sum game. And in fact, one that punishes discrimination. So if you won't sell to a certain group of people because of their race or their gender, you end up making less money. So it can be structured in ways to this third way thinking. It can be structured in ways to actually promote the types of pro-social behavior that we want to see. Though admittedly, it has not always been that way. I agree wholeheartedly. But one of the questions we like to end with is this sort of so what, now what? Which is,
That's the same thing?
Outstanding. I've just sent this like a hanging curveball right over the plate. So feel free to knock it out of the park.
So, Rodney, what is your so what, now what?
Well, so what? Oh, man. let's see. Now what is that we continue to have the conversations. Mm-hmm. We continue to examine. I wouldn't be an educator if I didn't talk about pedagogy, right? I mean, pedagogy is as in the ideology of our institutions, the ideology of our organizations. We have to continue to examine what we call the four P's of equity. The pedagogy of your institutions, the policies, because a lot of times our policies are inequity is coded into our policies. So we have to examine our policies looking for the equity. And like I said to my point, looking for inequity in most cases, things like, hairstyles or certain people can't have braided hair or length of an hair or what you wear or what you cannot wear. And mm-hmm. all those things lend itself to inequity. And then the third P is practice. How do we practice that equity that we have put in place? And then the last one, of course, is the people. We have to examine the people. In other words, we have great strategies a lot of times that we put in place, but the people, the culture of a place will not withstand that strategy. I mean, I got a great one. We had this thing called the New Deal back in the 1940s, where we were talking about the GI Bill and all of those things that were not race specific in writing, but they were administered, they were practiced in a race specific way. Whereas they didn't say that we couldn't give housing loans to Black guys, but Black guys didn't get housing loans when they came back from World War II. They didn't say that Black guys couldn't utilize the educational component of the GI Bill. But if you were a Black GI coming back to Kansas City, you couldn't go to college anywhere in Kansas City. And the access line. So you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. How it was practiced.
Because it was in Jim Crow era.
It was, right? How it was practiced was discriminatory. So we have to think about pedagogy, policy, practices, and people.
And remember that just like the New Deal in Rodney's example, this is what we mean by culture will eat strategy for breakfast, yeah. Right? That is the demonstration of culture eating strategy for breakfast. The Jim Crow culture ate up what was really
a
race neutral approach. Yeah. So Mike, to close it out on my so what, now what, it is so we are moving closer to in society out loud, calling out and talking about race. Now we need to move closer in doing the work of dismantling race inequity within our institutions, within our own personhood,
yeah.
And do the work and continue to be committed to the work, because that is what it takes. We can't stop short at having powerful conversations, which I'm so excited about. We have to continue to be motivated and mobilized with carrots in front of us, because we know that a more diverse and inclusive community is a stronger community. When one person feels, there's no limitation on the amount of safety that we feel. If one group feels safe, then in another one, then we are safer, mm-hmm. all of us. So that would be the so what, now what. So we understand, and now we are better positioned to do the work.
And let me just close with a couple quick things here. First of all, I think my hope is this, is when I asked whether it was a zero-sum game, my hope for the answer was it didn't have to be. And I don't believe it has to be. I think one could easily argue that it has been. That doesn't mean it has to be. And basically, using Mike's capitalist model, if basically efficiency and productivity are the things that drive decision-making, basically we have a sector of the population or sectors of the population on both ends of the equity spectrum that have been not as productive as they could have been for vastly different reasons. But nonetheless, mm-hmm. that's what they've been doing. So figuring out a new paradigm, I think, is something that helps us achieve a lot of the things we've talked about. And I think finally, what I want to say, I want to thank you both really very much for coming with us. I want to do this again because we sure ran out of time long before we got to some of the questions that we talked about in the beginning of this. And I do believe that we have an opportunity now like Stephanie said, that I don't recall. I'm the old guy here. I was in Kansas City as a student in the riots of 1968.
Wow.
I remember what it was like, and I remember, and I see the difference now. One major difference is when you look at the vast sea of faces out there, at least half of them are white.
Mm.
Which you did not see in 1968, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, which is even more interesting, and I think is that it's at the plaza. It's not on 14th and Prospect. And so as a result, what happens is the response is different. And hopefully, and by the way, the final point is this. I think we're very fortunate, whether you voted for him, didn't vote for him, like him, don't like him. I think the mayor has tried very, very hard to deal with this from a leadership perspective in a very different way than others might have done. And it hasn't been 100% successful.
Mm-hmm.
But we're a lot more fortunate than some cities and states are. So that's all I have, and really want to thank you both so much. And really, we're going to schedule another one. Maybe we ought to do one in 2 or 3 weeks and figure out whether we've made any progress.
Absolutely. Let's do it. Thank you so much.
And by the way, I don't mind going to work and say I support Mayor Q.
That's right.
Leading this broadcast, I'm Alan Katz on the left.
I'm Mike McShane on the right.
And thank you all very much.
To learn more about Rodney and Stephanie's work with Sofix Solutions, you can visit their website at www.sofixsolutionsgroup.com. American Public Square at Jewel is committed to its mission to change the quality and quantity of public discourse. Seeking to share our platform, we are here as conveners and connectors to bring about peace, justice, and unity for all in our community. American Public Square relies on the support of its members to do this important work. Please consider becoming a member today. You can do so at americanpublicsquare.org/membership. Be sure to follow American Public Square at Jewel on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at AM Public Square for the most recent episode of Both Sides and other At the Square podcasts, like our student-led podcast episodes. If you have feedback on this week's episode or any of our digital content, please visit our website at americanpublicsquare.org/contact to send our Both Sides team a message. We welcome your thoughts and hope you'll tune in next week to a new episode of Both Sides. American Public Square at Jewel is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization in Kansas City, Missouri, that seeks to bring non-like-minded people together for civil, fact-based conversations. To learn more, visit our website at www.americanpublicsquare.org.